Thank you. My name's Polly Pistol, and I'm an alcoholic. By God's grace, in a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't had a drink since April the 11th of 1977, and for that, I am eternally grateful. And I have a home group, and that's the third legacy group in Bellingham, Washington, and I have a sponsor, and my sponsor has a sponsor. And those things I need to be a member in good standing. And those are not the things that keep me sober, but those are the things that keep me a member in good standing in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I stay sober by a relationship with God, the 12 steps, the 12 traditions, and the 12 concepts. And there are not enough thank yous to thank you for having Dave and I here. There's just not enough thank yous. When Anders called and well, he didn't call, he emailed us and invited us to come, Dave and I were so excited. And last time we were here, we stayed with Mass at his mom's house. And it was wonderful. And so we got an email and it says, "Do you mind? Mass wants you to stay at his mom's house again." It was like, oh my God, yes! And it's wonderful to be here. It's wonderful to be back in Denmark. It's wonderful to see friends that we met before when we were here and to just reunite with everybody. And it's fabulous. And then to the friends that I just made in Stockholm, and they came, and Christine from Germany. I mean, it's just, these are the kind, I mean, this is AA. And the relationships and the friends we make, it's just priceless. It is so priceless. And just stay and enjoy this. This is the thing, you know, create the fellowship you crave. And because the fellowship, I can guarantee you the fellowship was the thing that attracted me first. I had no idea what the steps were and the traditions, you know, that were hanging on the wall. But I was so attracted to the fellowship. And I want to be an attraction. I want to be an attraction because, you know, I didn't understand what AA was, but I certainly liked what I saw. I liked your energy. I liked the way you welcomed me. I loved the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm just so grateful to be a part of it. I love my life. I love my life. I love the life that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. And because of that, today I am more involved in AA. I am busier in these rooms than I have ever been. I sponsor more people than I have ever sponsored, and I'm into more service than I've ever been into. And I have a really selfish reason for that. And that reason is, at 31 years of sobriety, I have so much to lose. I love my life, and I have so much to lose. And I was talking to a lady after Dave and I finished with the traditions, and I want to comment to her, but she made me think about some things. After she spoke to me, and she said, "Well, did you have any jealousy problems, or did you ever think of separating, or you know, because we have problems along the way?" And yes, those problems were there. They were absolutely there, and you just hang in there and you work them out. And what I said was, I said, it's just like AA. You commit. You make a commitment to stay sober, and I make a commitment to stay married. And sometimes what you do when you make a commitment is that you have to go through the hard stuff. And she says, "Well, were you ever jealous, or was he ever jealous?" And boy, it's a huge part of my story, the jealousy. And I guess that we've just reached an age, you know, by the time you get this old, I'm not really worried about him anymore. You know, so... But I used to be. And so I said, "Oh gosh, of course." And the reality is I sponsor all these gorgeous women. And, you know, they're younger than me, and most all of them are thinner than me. And Dave loves the women I sponsor, and they love him, you know, and it's just, and I had a hard time with that, you know. But one of the things that happened is that, You know, we had this program, and we learned to work through those. And what I had to be told by Dave in a loving way, you know, Polly, that's your problem. It's not my problem. It's your problem. And I had to take care, because it was my insecurities, and I was trying to put them on him and make it his fault. It's not his fault. So you learn a lot along the way, and yeah, and I think back, and you know, of the struggles when you're first married and the things that you go through, and I'm going to talk about some of that stuff because it's certainly part of my story. And that, you know, when you see us sitting here talking about the traditions, it looks like, oh, they've never had any problems in their life ever, and that's not true. Because just because we're sober and we're in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, life's been in session. And Dave and I have been married 28 years, and life's been in session. I've been sober 31 years, and life's been in session. So what I'm going to try to do, the book tells me that I should share in a general way what it used to be like, what happened, and what I'm trying to be like today, and I'm going to do that. And I want you to know that I am living, breathing proof that you can come to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and be a real alcoholic. An alcoholic, a real alcoholic that is talked about in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there is a solution. I am a real alcoholic. And I do not come from alcoholic parents. My daddy was 60 years old when he died, and he was 60 years sober. My mother was 87 years old when she died, and she was 87 years sober. Now, my parents were not the least bit impressed with my sobriety in AA. I mean, their deal was, if you just didn't drink, that wouldn't have happened to you anyway. However, I truly believe I was raised in a very fundamentalist church, Southern Baptist. I grew up in Texas, and I was raised Southern Baptist. And one of the things they said is, thou shalt not drink. I mean, it was a sin to drink. And, I mean, everything was a sin. I mean, as far as I could tell, everything was a sin. I mean, if it was fun or if it felt good, it was a sin. So, I mean, that was my perception of that. And I had this God, you know, this God that I had would just, I mean, talk about have problems with God. When I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I knew there was a God. I just wasn't really, you know, wanting to have much to do with him, because it was just like these preachers, they'd slam their fist on the podium and their faces would get real red, and they were talking about, you're born a sinner and you're going to die in hell, and if you've thought it, you've done it. And I don't know about any of you, but I was an alcoholic in the making, and I thought a lot. And so it was just like I just took on this feeling of, there's just no way I can ever be good enough for God. And I certainly did not get from my parents that I wasn't good enough. Now, my father was a rageaholic, and I became a rageaholic as well. And my dad, I believe, I know that there's no way for me to know this, but I believe it with my heart, that if my dad would have taken a drink, he would have been an alcoholic. My dad needed a drink. He needed a drink. And if he'd have taken a drink, he would have been an alcoholic. And both of my parents were abused children. And they found each other just like an Al-Anon and an AA. And neither one of them had any self-worth. And I am so grateful for the inventory steps. Because what happened is that before I took a look at my inventory, my sponsor says, why don't you take a look at your parents' inventory? And by doing so, I learned a lot by just stopping and looking at their lives before and how their lives were. And all my parents ever wanted to give me was love. All my parents ever wanted to give me was all the things they didn't have. My mother worked. I'm 68 years old. I can assure you that other little girls, when I was a little girl, their parents did not work. Their mother stayed at home, but my mother worked. So I was a latchkey kid before it was popular. But all they wanted to do was give me the things that they didn't have. My mother was a nurse, but my father only had a 9th grade education. And they wanted to give me dancing lessons and gymnastic lessons and do those things for me because they never got to have any of that. But what they couldn't give me, and they tried so hard to give me because they didn't have it, was self-esteem and self-worth. And see, today I know we cannot give that which we don't have. And they couldn't give it to me because they didn't have it. And I used to look at my dad's rage, and I used to say, there's no way I'm going to be like you. And I'd look at my mom, and she was just, you know, my dad would get really angry, and he'd start cussing and screaming, and it was always at her. And she would just kind of go into her shell and get really quiet. And I just thought, oh, you're such a wimp. And I was just so disgusted with that. And what I've learned about myself, thanks to the inventory steps, is I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the worst of both my parents, a raging wimp. And what I would do is I would rage at my little children, my 2 sons, and my husband. I would take all my anger out on them. And to the rest of the world, I just looked so nice. I was one of those kind of people that could just be screaming my lungs out at the kids or at my husband. And the phone would ring and I'd go, hello. So it was just this, you just couldn't, you know, you just didn't know who you were dealing with. Talk about Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. You just never knew who you were dealing with. And this was the person that came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've got to learn about that. But see, I had this thing inside of me. I was such a loved child, but I didn't feel it. I didn't know that I was loved. And when I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't know all these things were wrong with me. And I found out what was wrong with me because in this book it tells me what's wrong with me. It tells me that I am suffering from a spiritual malady. And if I am suffering from a spiritual malady, you can't love me enough, you can't give me enough, you can't do enough. There is not enough for a person like me. There is no way that you can give it to me because it has to come from a power greater than myself. And I did not have that relationship with God, and I had no self-worth, and I was suffering from spiritual bankruptcy. At 18 years old, I married an Air Force officer. And I knew I'd found my knight in shining armor, and we were going to sail off into the sunset and live happily ever after. Now, I have never, ever wanted to take care of myself. I want to be independent, but I don't want to take care of myself. You see these walking contradictions that we are. And see, the thing about it is, I just knew money, men, and mansions would fix me. That's the answer to it all. Money, men, and mansions. And I married this man, and he was handsome, and he was an officer in the Air Force, and I just had all these expectations of how I was going to live and how I was going to be taken care of, and I was 18 years old. What happened was, is we got married, and we moved to California, and I was living in Texas, it wasn't very a week or so, and I got this invitation in the mail from the base commander's wife that I was supposed to attend a coffee. And on this invitation was stamped mandatory, which means I have to show up. And I just instantly retreated into myself because I'm 18 years old and I'm uneducated. Now, I am still uneducated. And it's not because I couldn't get an education, because I believe you can do and be anything you want to do and be in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I've always wanted those letters after my name. I've just never wanted to go to school. So it's always been, I want the title, I just don't want to do the work. So I had to learn these things about myself. So now I'm sitting here with these overwhelming feelings of inadequacy. I mean, these women are going to be educated. These women are going to be sophisticated. And I'm none of those things. And I am so inferior to them. And I went there to the coffee, and I sit there, and I'm terrified. And this lady gets up behind the podium, much like I am right now, and she's speaking to all us little second lieutenant's wives, and she begins to tell us what we have to do in order to enhance our husband's career, how we're going to have the right dinner parties, how we're going to attend the right dinner parties, how we will be dressed appropriately, we'll wear the right length gloves, all the things that we're going to do in order to enhance his career. And I'm sitting there thinking, there is no way I can do this. I don't even know what side of the plate the forks go on. I mean, how am I going to, I don't know anything about this. I don't know how to do any of this. And I was so overwhelmed and so of just absolutely being so inadequate to do what I felt like they were asking me to do. A few weeks later, they had a luncheon. And I went to the luncheon. Of course, you were supposed to attend all this stuff. So I went to the luncheon. And there they had the sherry coming out of a fountain. And see, I'd been told all my life that people who drank were bad. And these people weren't bad. These were good people. And so this sherry's coming out of this fountain, and I just stuck my glass under it and got some sherry. And I drank it. And nothing really happened. I mean, there wasn't this big flash of light, and all of a sudden, you know, it went down and went out to the ends of my fingers, and all of a sudden I'm Rita Hayworth. And none of that happened. I mean, when Dave talks about sometimes about when he took his, when he finally got to drink as much as he wanted, it went down, and all of a sudden he was 6 foot tall, and all of a sudden his red hair turned brown and his freckles fell off. None of those things happened for me. All I know is I took a drink of that sherry, and for the first time, I could just breathe. I could just take a breath. It seemed like all my life I had this fear of what you're going to think of me, what people are going to think of me, all of it. And I took this drink of sherry, and I could just take a breath. And I had no idea. As the years went by, people started telling me what alcohol did to me. I didn't even realize what alcohol did for me until I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in this book, in the doctor's opinion, it talks about alcohol giving us that feeling of ease and comfort. If I took a drink of alcohol, I seemed to be able to be in social situations. I was afraid of people and afraid of being in social situations because I was so afraid of what you might think of me. And what it did is it allowed me to laugh in the right places, to just breathe, not to have all that anxiety going to where I just couldn't even take a deep breath. And alcohol allowed that to happen. And for a time it worked. It was something that worked for me. Along about 1962, we're stationed in a place called Loring Air Force Base, Maine. And it is the very tippy top of the east coast of the United States. And, I mean, at the very top, just right up at the tippy top of Maine. And I have two little boys. I don't have a clue how to be a parent to these two little boys. I don't know what to do with them. It's 50 below zero outside. I can't send them out to play. So these little boys are inside with me, and they're driving me crazy. I'm having a nervous breakdown every 20 minutes. These little boys are driving me crazy. And I end up going to an Air Force doctor, and he says, take these. And from 1962 until 1977, when I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I drank alcohol, and I took Librium and Valium and Seconal and Nemutol. And I'm here to tell you, if you take those kind of drugs and you drink alcohol, you're not an active alcoholic. I was not someone who was your party girl. I just did my dying on my living room sofa. I just laid there and watched soap operas and listened to Joan Baez sing the blues. I just could not function. I believe with all my heart that the disease of alcoholism is a family disease, and that everybody who lives with a practicing alcoholic is affected by the disease of alcoholism. And my two little boys, my sons were 14 and 16 years old when I got sober. I drug my children through the disease of alcoholism, and my children have been traumatized in every way. And I want you to know today that I am a woman who never should have been allowed to have her children. I am a woman who abused my children in every way. I physically, emotionally, spiritually abused my children. And most of all, by blatant neglect. I simply was unable to take care of these children. And when I had to do a fifth step with my sponsor, my first sponsor had been a priest, he had been a captain in the Navy, and he was an only child. And I believe that God puts us with exactly the right people to do what we need to do. And this man was put in my life. And this man had 12-stepped me out of a motel, and he loved me. And what happened was is he loved me, and he was willing to get in my face and tell me the truth, whether I wanted to hear it or not. And he looked at me and he said, "Polly, you are a child abuser. You have abused your children in every way, and you need to go make amends to your boys." And I didn't know how to do that. And he says, "Well, I'm going to tell you how to do that." And that's what I think good sponsorship is about. When we get ready to, when we do our inventory and we get ready to go make amends, we need good sponsorship. And I didn't know how I was going to make amends to my sons. And he told me that I didn't get to do watered down AA. I didn't get to go in there and say, "I'm so sorry I hurt you." I was to say, "I am so sorry I abused you." And he said, "Those boys are going to have something to say to you." And when I told them how sorry I was and that I would do anything I could to make it right and if they had anything to say to me. Well, I'll tell you, at 14 and 16, my sons were very angry. They were very angry. And they had a lot to say that day. And my AA sponsor told me, he said, "You don't get to say, 'Well, you shouldn't feel that way. I'm sober today.' You don't get to say that." He says, "The only thing that you get to say is, 'I am so sorry that I did that to you, and I will spend the rest of my life being the very best mom I can be.'" And I am so grateful. I am so grateful for that kind of sponsorship. Because what happened was, is I got to make amends to my children, and I got to let them see that what's wrong with them and why they feel so crazy is because it wasn't their fault. It wasn't their fault. And what happened was, is I got to make amends to them, even though they didn't really believe anything I was saying that day. They didn't believe it. But what I got to do is I got to say it. And I've been able to spend the past 31 years doing exactly what I said I would do. And that is be the very best mom I can be. And sometimes that hasn't been easy, to be the very best mom I can be. Because that's been allowing adult children to make mistakes and do what they have to do. And sometimes that's not easy because it's not my business. I'm just going to tell you a few things that, I want to tell you one story about James. Because the reason I say this is because my son James is in AA and he speaks as well. And James talks about being a little boy. See, alcoholism is a family disease. We have a beautiful chapter about the family afterwards that talks about this disease. And in there, it says the head of the house caused most of the problems. And it also says that we will not even the score in this lifetime. So it's not about what my sons do for me. It's all about what I do for them. It's what kind of mom am I to them, not what kind of sons they are to me. And my son was probably about 10 years old, and he tells this story about waking up one morning, and his mom was passed out on the kitchen floor. She was laying there with a drink spilt. And that he got up, he said he just looked, that here's his reality, just being totally numb. That's his reality. And what he does is he just steps over me, gets his cereal, puts it together, puts the box away, the bowl away, steps back over me, sits down, and eats his breakfast, and feels nothing. That's the disease of alcoholism. That's what happens. And my oldest son was the one who took care of me. And, you know, we as alcoholics, when we pass out, we don't breathe too good. And many is the time I've come to with my oldest son screaming at me, "Mom, wake up, are you dead?" And me to come to and see the fear in his eyes. And, you know, for the past 31 years, I haven't had to see that kind of fear in anybody's eyes because of something I'm doing. And for that, I've been overpaid. I don't have a lot of funny stories to tell. I slept through it. You know, I've always wanted, I have a sponsee that had this affair with a preacher with one leg. I mean, I've been wanting to have all, I mean, you know, what happened for me is I did all my affairs sober in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's, I don't recommend that at all. And at any rate, I just want to tell you a few things that brought me to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a car wreck in Irving, Texas, and I ended up calling the police and telling them that my car had been stolen. And here comes the police with my husband, and I'm taken to the Irving police station, and I get to see that look on the non-alcoholic's face that just doesn't understand why we do the things we do. And this policeman looked at my husband with so much disgust, and he says, "Why don't you just take her home and sober her up?" And on the way home, my husband said, "Polly, there's a treatment center, and it's not far from our house, and I wish you would go." And I entered treatment for the first time. And I loved what I saw. This was not a fancy treatment center. This was a 7-day detox. And I went into this treatment center. And I loved, they started taking us to 2 and 3 meetings a day of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I loved it. I loved the laughter. I loved the hugging. I loved Alcoholics Anonymous. But there was just something down inside of me that said, "Polly, people like you just don't become alcoholic." And Dr. Thiebold says in AA Comes of Age, there's 2 characteristics found in every alcoholic: grandiosity and defiant individuality. Dave says only an alcoholic can lay in the gutter feeling superior to those looking down on him. And here I was. People like me just don't become alcoholic. And what I did while I was in that treatment center, I had a jitterhouse romance. You know, where sick falls in love with sick and you walk off into happy destiny. We walked off into happy destiny for 58 days. And I was 12-stepped by the man, by Frank, who would be my first sponsor. And I was brought back into that treatment center more dead than alive. And I had been beaten up and numerous and sundry other things. And I'd reached that place in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that talks about pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Because I knew what the problem was. The problem was sobriety. I can't live sober inside my own skin. I can't live sober with what happened in that motel room. I can't live sober with the kind of mother I've become and the kind of wife I've become and the kind of daughter I've become. And I've heard in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that men hate what they've done and women hate what they have become. And I hated what I had become. And I knew that there was no way I could live sober. And you see, I didn't know anything about the disease of alcoholism. I didn't know about the 12 steps, and I didn't know about the 12 traditions, and I didn't know about the concepts. I knew nothing about you. All I knew was, is I can't live sober inside my own skin. And what I did when that 7 days was up is I got a bottle of scotch and I got a bottle of Valium and I checked into a motel. I don't believe that there's anybody in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that doesn't have an angel in your life. Someone who leads us to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. It can be a spouse that says you can't live here anymore because your disease is killing our family. Maybe it's a teenage child and you can't live here because what's happening to you is destroying the rest of the family. Maybe your job, bye girls, I love you. Maybe your job says you can't work here unless you get sober. Or maybe you're here in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous because you got a nudge from the judge. Whatever, we have an angel in our life and someone leads us to this program. And I had such a woman in my life. And she knew nothing about the disease of alcoholism, but she loved me. And she said that day that something came over her. And I know what that something was. That was God working in my life through her. And she drove around and she found my car parked outside this motel. And I had just closed the door. It wasn't latched. And she pushed it open. And she found me laying there. And on April the 8th of 1977, I was pronounced dead on arrival in a hospital in Bedford, Texas. Now, that didn't take because I'm standing here today. But I have to tell you about the miracle of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have to tell you about the miracle of God in my life. I truly believe that I am the miracle of divine intervention, that God intervened in my life. Because what happened is I began to breathe. And I am so grateful for this program. And I believe that every one of us who gets the blessing of sobriety, that gets to stay sober, has the gift of grace. We are given the gift of grace. And everybody who walks through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous is given the gift of grace. The thing that happens is more of us than stay. More of us lay the gift down and walk out the door. Because to do the work is so hard. We have to do the work here. There's work to do. If we have to change or go. That's all there is to it. We have to change or go. And if we change by working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, because it's through those steps that I developed a relationship with God, a God that would carry me through the high spots and the low spots, as it talks about in Bill's story. That God, the one that taught me how to be of service, go be of service, or you won't survive the low spots in your sobriety. And I am so grateful that I was willing. I am so grateful for the gift of desperation. And I am so grateful for the gift of willingness. Because I believe it was that desperation that gave me the gift of willingness. That I was willing to do what people told me to do, even though I totally believed it was ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. I left that treatment center. I entered that treatment center. In the state of California, in the state of Texas, I'm sorry, they did not take kindly to people who try to kill themselves. So I got put on one of those little 72-hour holds, and I was put in a psychiatric hospital, which was enough time for my husband to obtain a court order that said I was a detriment to myself and others. And I was court committed to a treatment center in Dallas, Texas. And I entered that treatment center on April the 11th of 1977. And I stayed there for 6 weeks. And when I left that treatment center, I got busy in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. We had people that came into the treatment center that brought the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they took us to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. So when I got out of that treatment center, I got busy in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went back to that man who had 12-stepped me out of that motel room, and I asked him if he would sponsor me. And he began to take me through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and carry me along this journey. When I first came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had no idea. I didn't know what a sponsor was supposed to do. I didn't know that much about the steps. I didn't know anything about the traditions. And I began to do what I was told to do. I was told to give service. And I was given the basics in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I live pretty much by those basics today. I was told, if you're asked to do something in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, the answer is yes. Just like what Mass said. If it's nothing on the calendar, that's what I do. I know to do service. I was told to clean up the cups and pick up the chairs and be of service in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I am so grateful that I got that kind of direction early on. When I was 3 years sober, I had met Dave when I was 6 months sober. And we were AA friends. I was talking to somebody else and said that they were friends with their husbands for 3 years. And Dave and I were friends for 3 years. And I'd had a lot of affairs in AA. Because you see, what I was doing is I was looking for love in all the wrong places. I just knew if you'd love me enough, I'd be okay. You see, I didn't understand it was going to have to come from the inside out. I just knew if you'd love me enough, I'd be okay. And I had to self-destruct in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have such a passion today about this as a program of attraction. And I was not an attraction when I first came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I guess it depends on your point of view, but it's, but I was not, I had to hurt myself and self-destruct. And the thing about it is, Dave and I were friends, and we were just AA friends. And Dave sponsored some of the men that I had had affairs with. So Dave knew about me. He knew more about me than he needed to. And Dave and I often say, if we'd have known we were going to get married, we'd have never told each other the things we told each other. And because there was just, we just knew so much about each other. And so Dave had moved to Salt Lake City, and he came back to Fort Worth for a job. And he told me, he said, "Polly, I'm in love with you. But," he said, "you need to get something straight. I don't want to have an affair with you. I want to marry you." And you see, things like that aren't supposed to happen to people like me. And so when I was 3.5 years sober and Dave was 4.5 years sober, we got married. Neither one of us knew how to have a marriage. We didn't even know how to have a relationship. We didn't know how. But what we knew is that we wanted to get married and we wanted to stay married. And we knew that we really loved each other and we didn't want to destroy it. And I'm Dave's fourth wife. And those of you who've heard Dave, our Al-Anon friend says Dave is the only common denominator in all four of those marriages. And we wanted to stay married, and both of us knew how to take a hostage, but we didn't know how to stay married. And my AA sponsor had been a priest, and he had left the priesthood when his mother died, because he had been a priest because that's what she wanted him to do. And when she died, he left the priesthood. He married a Taiwanian woman that he had been in love with for a lot of years. And Frank, I wanted what Frank had. I wanted what he had. And he says, "Well, Polly, you and Dave need to get an AA and plant yourself firmly, like two oak trees." And he says, "And you need to nurture yourself with the steps and the traditions and the concepts." And he says, "And like two oak trees, you'll grow strong. But if you lean on one or the other, one of you will fall. You'll fall over. Both of you will fall." He says, "You have to grow strong." And he says, "And like the oak tree, one day you'll look up and you can't tell where one begins and the other one ends." And I wanted that. But I knew that Dave couldn't be my sponsor, and he couldn't drag me along, and I couldn't drag him along. We had to plant ourselves firmly, and we had to be firm in our own programs. And I have an Al-Anon sponsor, and my Al-Anon sponsor, I'd see her and Albert, and her and I would go to Woman to Woman or one of the things we'd go to, and she'd open up her suitcase and she'd have all these love letters in there. And gosh, her and Albert were almost married 50 years before he died, and that would happen, and I'd say, "Oh my God, I want what they have. You know, I want romance in my life for 50 years." And they said, "Well, this is what you do." He says, "There's some simple words. I'm sorry. I was wrong. Please forgive me." And you know what? You don't really have to be wrong. We just have to learn to lay the ego down and say it. Because it has to start somewhere. We have to find a way to start somewhere. Because somewhere we've got to begin to talk and communicate. And Dave and I looked at each other and thought, "Oh, we can do that." And then we met this couple in Omaha, and they're the ones who showed us the traditions in relationships. So this is not anything that Dave and I made up. This is stuff that was given to us by people who had the kind of relationships we wanted, because we wanted a good relationship and to be happy and to stay married. And we didn't know how to do that. And so we began this marriage. And first of all, let me just tell you that Dave has two children, and I have two children. And I'm here to tell you, you put some stepkids together, and you're going to put some stress on a relationship. And out of those four kids, three of them are alcoholics and drug addicts. And one of them had grave emotional and mental disorders. So, I mean, what an order. I can't go through with it. And so Dave and I had to work through that. We had to work through these kids. And the only child that ended up living with us was my youngest son. And he was an alcoholic and a drug addict. So he was tons of fun. So Dave and I today, I want to kind of tell you, well, I'm going to go on with a few other things that I'm going to tell you about the kids. Dave and I have had some challenges in our sobriety. Along about 1993, the bottom fell out of aerospace in Southern California. And what happened was, is that Dave lost his job. Dave's a computer scientist, and he was in middle management, and he lost his job. And what happened was, is the world was not looking for a 57-year-old computer scientist. And what happened was, is Dave did not really work again in his field for 2 years. And he was working like two minimum wage jobs. And we ended up losing our home. We lost our home. We ended up having to file bankruptcy, doing things that just were horribly humiliating. And Dave and I are 16 and 17 years sober. And I'm here to tell you, I had my fist at God. I mean, look at what I do for you. I mean, I sponsor all these women. I'm into all this service. I do all these things. And this is my reward. You know, I'm going to file bankruptcy, lose my house. And, of course, that, you know, what am I thinking? Because what really is, all I get in AA is sober and a relationship with God. And see, what happens is if I get sober and I get that relationship in God, with God, then God can bring me through anything. And I'm here to tell you that there's life after bankruptcy and there's life after foreclosure. Because Dave and I sat one day and people would call us up and say, you know, invite us to dinner. And of course we'd say, oh, sorry, we can't go. And finally they'd say, you're not saying no, we're paying. And it was like, oh, that was so humiliating. What happened is we grew. And Dave and I had done some things that we thought were the right thing to do. Because Dave was a computer scientist, and we knew that he would find work. Or at least, I mean, headhunters were calling him all the time. This is the way we had lived prior to this. And just knew that he would find work. So what we were doing was things like making house payments with a credit card when we couldn't afford to make house payments, when my salary wouldn't do that. We've learned some really hard lessons, but they've been good lessons. And I'd like to tell you what those two lessons, the biggest lessons were. One was, is that a marriage can survive anything. And Dave looked at me one day and he said, Polly, Kris Kristofferson wrote a song and Janis Joplin sang it, as freedom's having nothing left to lose. And he said, we have God, we have AA, and we have each other. And we're going to be fine. And I had terrible fear of financial insecurity. Absolutely terrible fear. I just knew that I had, that, you know, you had to make a lot of money. You had to do these things or, you know, what was going to happen to you? Had all these fears. I did not trust God to take care of me. I did not have any trust in God that he would take care of me. And then the other lesson I learned is, doesn't matter what the situation is, no matter what, you don't spend money you don't have. Doesn't matter what the situation is. And then, not long after that, we lost Dave's son, Mike. Mike died in 2002. And Mike had called Dave and told him that he wanted to get sober. And Dave said, well, Mike, you have to go to AA. And then shortly after, when he went to a treatment center, we found out that Mike was HIV positive. And he died 9 years later. He died sober in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when he was sick and on his deathbed, the hospice nurse, he wouldn't pass. And she said, he's waiting on someone. And Dave's daughter came in. We had not seen his daughter in 15 years because Dave's daughter was out on the streets of Denver doing what women have to do to maintain a cocaine and alcohol habit. And what she did not want to come to the family until she had a year sober. But she came to her brother's bedside, and she was 8 months sober. And it was the miracle of miracles. When I was 6.5 years sober, my youngest son called me on the phone and he said, Mom, I want what you have. And 6.5 years before, he did not want what I had. 6.5 years before, I was supposed to attend a function at his school. And he stood and screamed at me with all the anger any child could have at a mother. And he said, don't you dare show up at my school because I am ashamed of you. And 6.5 years later, he wants what I have. Great events. On page 164 in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about great events will come to pass. That's the great fact for us all. And the great events have just continued to come to pass. James ended up marrying Kelly. James just celebrated 25 years of sobriety. Kelly in July will have 20 years of sobriety. And we've gotten to go to Bill W.'s big family reunions. We get to celebrate sobriety as a family. And 15 years ago in 1993, the same time we were losing all this stuff, we had a gift, a huge, great, big, wonderful gift from God. And that was Ryan. Our first grandchild was born. And I'm telling you, he was just like a little cherub. He had just blonde, curly hair, and he was just the cutest thing that ever walked the face of the earth. And when he was 18 months old, we got some devastating news. We found out that Ryan was profoundly deaf. And one more time, I had my fist at God. How can this be happening? You know, we want our baby. People have babies all the time, and they're born perfectly healthy, and they don't even want them. And our baby's born deaf. How can this be happening? And see, my perception, the disease of alcoholism is a disease of perception. And my perception of reality is distorted. I don't know what God's plan is. I don't know what God's going to do. But what happens is this little boy has been absolutely the gift of gifts. This is the most courageous little boy I have ever met. Ryan's 15 now. And Ryan is totally integrated into public school. He goes to Evanston High School, which is a school of 4,400 students. And he suits up and shows up every day, and he's the only deaf child in that school. And here I look at myself and how I don't fit in, I'm different, and all this. And I felt that way. Ryan is that way. Ryan is different, and he suits up and he shows up every day for school. And you know what? He's on the honor roll, and he's deaf. And you know what? You know who gets the credit for all of that? His parents. Because of you, James and Kelly were relieved of the bondage of self. And when it comes to this child, it never costs too much. It never takes too much. They don't have to do too much. It's absolutely beautiful to watch them interact with this child and what has happened as a result of that. And James and Kelly have two more children. My oldest son had grave emotional and mental disorders. And I really have a lot of identification with Russ. He and I were really more alike. And that is, Russ suffered with a lot of depression. And I have suffered with a lot of depression in and out of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, because that last suicide I had was not the first one I had ever tried. And I knew that if I knew how he felt inside, and I knew how difficult life was for him. And Russ was one of these people that would hurt himself and cut on himself. And I understood that, because I would do that. Because if I could just feel the physical pain, it was better than having to feel the emotional pain. And I had to watch my son do that to himself. And I just thought, I can't stand this. I cannot watch this. And what happened was, my son, while I was sober in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, tried to kill himself 6 times. And I just thought, I can't stay sober and live through this. I had one son trying to kill himself and another one behind alcohol and drugs trying to kill himself. But I can tell you, I was just devastated. And I went to an AA meeting one time and I was just apart. I just didn't know what I was going to do, and I started talking about these kids and this man in the back. And I'm one of these people, you know, you take the mess to your sponsor and the solution to AA. And I brought the mess that day to AA. And this old man in the back, and he did me a favor, but I couldn't stand it at the time. And he just hollered out, "You need to just turn those kids over." And I jumped up out of my seat and I said, "Would you kindly tell me how to do that?" And that next day, I went to Al-Anon. And you know, Al-Anon told me how to do that. I found out how to do that. And I was able to get the help I needed in order to walk through these children. And when I was 6.5 years sober, my youngest son, James, called me on the phone and says, "Mom, I want what you have." 6.5 years before, he didn't want what I had. And he got sober. My oldest son, Russ, hasn't tried to hurt himself in 10 years, or more than that. It's more than 10 years. It's probably about 15. And but he still has a lot of struggles, And he doesn't know how to talk. You see, that happens to children who are raised in alcoholic families. They don't know how to talk. And if they don't go to Al-Anon or to Alateen or the things that they need to do, they don't learn that. They don't learn how to share their feelings. And Russ can't share his feelings. And he's had his life has been in turmoil for a long time. And now he and his wife have 2 granddaughters. And Dave and I are really close to them, because we lived by them. And Dave, when he was out of work, he took care of Katie. And Dave never had been around kids, really. But he took care of Katie when he was out of work. And now they're separating. And the girls are 12 and 10. And Russ and Cheryl got into a lot of financial problems because the economy is so bad in the States, and they ended up losing their house. And I just said to Russ one day, I said, "I just wish you would have talked to me when this was going down." And he says, "Well, what could you have done?" And I said, "Well, I probably couldn't have done anything, but I could have shared my experience, strength, and hope with you. Because what happened is you made the same mistake we did. You spent money you didn't have. And maybe if you'd have listened to our experience, strength, and hope, you might have let go a lot sooner." Which is what we needed to do, was to let go and not try to hold on to the stuff. And it's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking to watch your children have struggles. But what I've learned here, and what I've learned in Al-Anon is that my children have a higher power, and it's not me. It's not me. And they have a journey. And my job is to allow them. I mean, these are grown men. These men are 46 and 48 years old. These are grown men. And what I need to do is allow them the journey that they have. And my job is still the same job that Frank told me 31 years ago. It's the same job. And that's to be the very best mom I can be. And I'm here to tell you I am a woman who abused my children. And today my children let me have their children. That's what you've done for me. They let me have them a lot. And that's what you've done for me. Because today I am a dynamite grandma. And that's a gift. That's a gift. Thank you. My granddaughters, they're always saying, "Grandma, you are so much fun." And it's fabulous. It's fabulous to have these relationships. My life is beyond my greatest expectation. Dave usually tells this in his story, and since he didn't, I'm going to tell it. But when I got sober in Center Hospital, I had been in treatment. It was my third treatment. And when I went into this treatment center, I was, you know, coming off booze, and I was starting to get the shakes and all, and I knew that all I had to do was just walk up to the nurse's station. I'd get my tablets, you know, to take. And the director there said that day, he said, "Not this time, Polly. You're going to find out how sick you really are." And he said, "Here's a shot of Dilantin, and I promise you I'm not going to let you die. But you need to know how sick you are." And 4 days later, I walked out of that room, and I had pulled most of my hair out of my head, and I had scratched my face because things were crawling on me and things had happened. And I looked at him, and I was so angry. I was just beside myself, and I was screaming at him in the hall, and I said, "You're a monster. You don't treat anybody the way you've just treated me." And he looked at me with so much love. And he said, "Polly, if you make it, you're going to love me. If you don't, it really doesn't matter." And so if your sponsor gets in your face and tells you stuff you don't want to hear, just remember, if you make it, you're going to love him or her. If you don't, it really doesn't matter. God bless you. I love you.